quantitative, yes, that's right, quantitative methods in assessing health and well-being effects of lung reclamation. We have Michael Walsh here presenting. Gilad Zuckerman is not able to be here, but Michael will do a wonderful job, I'm sure.
Okay, sure, thanks. Okay, thanks, Michael. Sorry about the display issues. For me, it's looking great, no problem. Okay, so this is a version of the abstract where we say there's, and can you read it, particularly from the back of the room, we've got some seats towards the front as well, if anyone wants to avail themselves of that. The print is quite big on what I'm looking at. Okay, there's no shortage of accounts of language reclamation that make claims there are links between language reclamation and health and well-being, including one by me. And there are some other references, but the majority of these accounts are qualitative. So when I got into language revival about 20 years ago, the thing that really struck me between the eyes was the fact that Indigenous communities were feeling a lot better about themselves once language revival was starting to progress. But in this paper, we present preliminary results from a 5-year study of Bunkala language reclamation. This is funded by the National Health and Medical Research Council and is from 2017 to 2021. If you go to Ethnologue, a catalogue of the world's languages, it will describe the 2016 edition, at least. We're okay, good. So now I can't see, but you guys can, which is the way it should be, in the interest of health and well-being. Okay, so Ethnologue describes Bunkala, which is a language spoken, or was spoken, west of Adelaide in the state of South Australia, as being extinct and having no L1 speakers. So just referring back to Te Tuka's excellent plenary this morning, no gloom and doom, guys. This is a language that's supposedly extinct, according to the 2016 issue of Ethnologue. Nevertheless, we'll see that there's lots of activity going on. So our team includes a whole lot of health professionals. There are just two linguists on board, myself and Gilad Zuckerman. That's why we've put ourselves forward as the presenters, but later we'll see other potential presenters. Okay, so Bunkala language, culture and heritage. The traditional territory of the Bunkala lies to the west of Adelaide in the state of South Australia. Much of the community can be found in the towns of Port Augusta and Port Lincoln. Language loss in the Bunkala community can be attributed to the immediate and ongoing effects, impacts of the stolen generations involving the forcible removal of children. So roughly the equivalent in North America are residential schools. Some of the stolen generations went to schools or so-called mission and other settlements, and this had a disastrous effect not only on their language continuity but their lives in general. So the birthright of access to their language was not transferred to the next generation. But Bunkala people in Port Augusta and Port Lincoln have been working with my colleague Gilad Zuckerman from the University of Adelaide to undertake language reclamation activities. Much of this work involved trying to bring back to life the content of a Bunkala dictionary and grammar that was written in 1844 by a Lutheran missionary to Port Lincoln, Clamor Wilhelm Schurmann, who documented more than 3,000 Bunkala words and noted grammatical patterns. But by the time Gilad began work on the language reclamation, around about 2011 or so, there was very little knowledge in the community. And I've put here some words from one of the language activists, a Bunkala man, Stephen Atkinson, so that you can hear some of what he has to say from the heart. As a child living in the bush around Iron Knob, Wahala and Port Augusta in South Australia, my mother ran through the sandhills playing and talking with her brothers and sisters in their native Bunkala tongue. Life seemed to be happy and free. The government of the time, in their perceived arrogance or possible misled naivety, outlawed the speaking of Aboriginal languages in government-supported institutions for many years, and ours was almost completely wiped out. In my mother's case, she was taken to a brethren-run mission in Port Augusta called Umiwara Mission. Here my mother was forced not to speak a native Bungala tongue, even though she could speak it fluently when she arrived at 8 years of old, 8 years of age. In the time she spent there, she lost her language to a point where she wasn't able to put a sentence together when she left. To put this in perspective a bit, there's Stephen Atkinson. I'll give him an age of about 45, I don't really know exactly, but let's say his mother was born, is about 65, that means she was born around about 1953. When she was taken away, it's about 1961. So we're not talking about ancient history, the exact years could change up or down a bit, but that's what we're talking about. A disastrous effect on Bungala language activity from about that time. So this places Bungala territory in the state of South Australia, the inset within Australia, and we'll give you some orientation about the places that are involved. The language and wellbeing study team consists of 14 people. The top one, Lita Seaback, is the study coordinator. The second bottom one is me. The two in the middle, Alan Rosen, who's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Sydney, and Gillard Zuckerman, are the other two non-Indigenous people. Of the 14 people involved in the project, 10 are Indigenous, a number of them Bungala, but others, like Alex Brown, for instance, a heavily credentialed health professional, possibly the most heavily credentialed Aboriginal health professional in Australia, with basic medical qualifications, MD in US terms, Masters of Public Health, and a PhD. This bloke is serious and has helped us get the major grant from the National Health and Medical Research Council. But to indicate there's more people than just that, you can see me roughly in the middle, Gillard over to the left somewhat, and a whole bunch of Bungala people. So as mentioned, it's a 5-year National Health and Medical Research Council grant, and we're trying to systematically assess the mental health and social and emotional well-being impacts on language reclamation. We're using a mixed methods approach, which has 4 objectives, which I'll just let you read for yourself for a while. How am I going for time, Michael?
You're not the 10-minute
mark. Okay, good. So the important punchline, I guess, is number 4, to prospectively assess mental health and social and emotional well-being of community-based language reclamation workshop participants over the course of the project. So in late 2017, remembering the grant only started in 2017, Lita Seaback, the study coordinator, and her Indigenous research assistant, Seth, conducted 16 interviews with participants from Port Augusta and Port Lincoln. So these were semi-structured interview questions focused on participants' experiences, and the idea was to basically take a broad definition of health and well-being and extract from these community positions the questionnaire which would lead to the actual program of assessing their mental health benefits. So the analysis was thematic, involving a deductive approach using the electronic software program Envivo to identify analytic categories directly from the interview material. Anyone who wants to ask me about Envivo in question time, direct the messages to Lita Seaback. She's got a good Googleable name, and I know nothing about Envivo because I'm not doing the health issues, I'm doing the linguistic side of things. So in late 2017 and early January 2018, there was feedback on the preliminary findings, and the purpose of that feedback was to basically seek community consensus as to whether the emerging themes had been interpreted correctly and to provide an opportunity to identify any other impacts and so on that did not come through the initial interviews. Now, from my way of thinking, this is a fairly laborious process, but it means that ultimately, by the time we got the community consensus building, the results were then presented to the full investigator team in March 2018, so less than a year ago. I wish it could have all happened a lot faster, but then we wouldn't have had the relatively informed community consent. These are some examples of the preliminary findings from the interviews. When we're talking inside, it's just us talking. When you're talking outside, you're breathing language into the land and into the sea and into the air and into the birds and into the fish, into the trees, and you're awakening that will with all that you're awakening that with all that spirit. You're speaking life into all our ancient spirits out there, and they're sitting around listening. Now, plenty of you would be familiar with comments like this, but the important thing that we were trying to do was get direct words from the interviews and use those to develop the actual measurement of the impacts of Indigenous language reclamation. So I've left that up for a little while so you can skim through it at high speed. Otherwise, following the semi-structured interview phase of the study, a number of key themes or domains of impact were identified, and some of those included connection to ancestors, spirit and spirituality, connection to country, etc. One of the team, an Indigenous psychologist, Graham G, has put this together into a social and emotional well-being framework, which is shown in the diagram up on the screen, which is certainly too small for me to read off my own screen, but you guys get the bigger version, so there you are. However, I'm giving a full reference to Graham G. et al.'s article at the end of this session, and I'm quite happy to make my slides available to people who should find that useful for them. So our task then is to translate these interview themes into questionnaire domains, and you'll see some examples of what's shown. On the left, there are themes that emerge from the interviews. On the right are the ways that these themes became domains of impact, which align with existing quantitative scales or subscales. So there are domains of draft questionnaire, including happiness or excitement, recognition, resilience, optimism, positivity, and so on. We then want to translate the interview themes into questionnaire domains. I've kind of already said that in a way, but here are some examples. Supporting quotes on the left, domain in the second column, questionnaires, which are derived again from instruments that I know practically nothing about, like the ARRQ, the Aboriginal Resilience and Recovery Questionnaire, and the Growth and Empowerment Scale. That's what the third column is talking about. And then we get to the proposed questionnaire items. So the first one, I feel very happy with myself and my life. Number two, I feel pride in my achievements, and so on. Okay, so as mentioned, there are some of these existing quantitative assessment tools, and they operate in participation with an organisation called BLANC, BLANC being short for Bunkala Language Advisory Committee, and of course the idea is that we Bunkala are BLANCs and our organisation is BLANC, B-L-A-C. So they began to select specific items, questions that directly align with the theoretical domains extracted from the interview data. So the draft assessment tool proceeded through a facilitated focus group process with BLANC and investigators to clarify local idioms of distress, etc. And this is drawn partly or refined partly through a 9-item patient health questionnaire, which the chief investigator that I mentioned earlier on, Alex Brown, who's the heavily credentialed health professional, has adapted for use with Aboriginal patients previously. So Alex, apart from being from the Yuin group in the south coast of New South Wales and not having much of his own language, has been involved in various other projects in health and language across Australia. So what are the next steps? They're to finalise the questionnaire, and this will involve further Bunkala community participation in critiquing the questionnaire, looking for face validity, cultural appropriateness, understandable response categories, brevity importantly, ability to self-complete, priority, prior use in cross-cultural settings, and robot psychometric properties. And what's going to happen is that the questionnaire will be used for approximately 100 Aboriginal people who become involved in a Bunkala language education program. So parallel with the mental health assessment is a kind of, well, language education program as shown there. That's mainly being run by Gilad Zuckerman with some input from me. So those 100 people are the ones who are in the process of language revival. There are then some 300 Aboriginal people living on the Eyre Peninsula who are not involved in Bunkala language activities, and so they're the ones that act as a so-called control group. We hope to begin baseline assessments in early 2019, as well as being used for the remainder of this study. It's hoped the assessment tool may have broader applicability for measuring the impacts of Indigenous language reclamations activities both within Australia and internationally. So this paper draws heavily on a paper which is said there to be published in 2018. It only came out about 2 weeks ago. So anyway, 2019, let's say. I've never published an article with more than four authors in the past, and this one has 14. Triskaidekaphobically, I'm worried about being number 13 in the list, but what can you do? Regrettably, these conference proceedings seem to be behind some kind of firewall, so you may have to pay $50 in order to get access to our paper along with the rest of the stuff. I deeply regret this, but that's the way it seems to have been set up. So the Mental Health Services Adelaide conference that was held in August 2018 is where that paper is developed in more detail than I can do justice to right at the moment. Then the reference to Graham G and his Aboriginal psychologist colleague Pat Dudgeon is set out in a volume edited by Pat Dudgeon. Dudgeon and some others, and fortunately this one is available as a freely downloadable PDF, and again if you contact me for slides then you can get the whole lot as shown. So that's it. I think I've got 1 minute left. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Okay, we have a good amount of time for questions here.
John.
Yeah, the enrollment figures seem fairly high. There's a strong expectation of only 100 language course participants and 300 languages.
Well, getting 300 non-participants is the easy bit because you don't actually have to do anything. They're there on the Eyre Peninsula, and that's, I guess, a matter of public fact. But I did show one slide with some of the Bunkala mob.
Yeah.
And you can see there was, it wasn't just the 14 members of the team, there were more people, including people who weren't actually shown in that. Well, that's a good question, I'll check it out. Basically you're asking, is the 100 the 100 people involved in Bunkala language revival, is that a figure a bit inflated, I take as the takeaway message from that question?
Well, that would be the easier ones to enrol, I would imagine, because if they're going to be motivated enough to do the course, then they'll have to do a questionnaire.
Yeah. Yeah.
300 non-enrolled people doing a questionnaire on their mental health might be a bigger ask.
Fortunately, I don't have to do the the interviews, but yeah, it's a good point. Yes.
Are you able to share the either the content or the form or both of the question items, the 9 items on your questionnaire?
Unfortunately, the health professionals seem to be kind of, we'll show you those later and say, okay, well, I like to see things soon, early, but no, I can't share it
okay,
with you
no
at
worries.
The moment, sorry. Yes, sorry, I missed you earlier.
I have a question about the, I guess the idea of using quantitative data in general, and I think it's great because I work sphere, and we constantly have to justify to the government saying it, because people give me money pretty easily.
Yeah.
But when you actually read what they're looking at, the things that they were doing were comparing two models that aren't comparable, and so what they're actually saying is compare to three other variables, not 40 other variables.
Right.
And so do you think there's a danger in sort of having these interdisciplinary teams that don't necessarily communicate necessarily everything properly, because you can't be an expert in everything.
Sure. There is a potential danger, and I've already confessed that I don't know what in vivo is and the whatever GEM, the GEM, and such like. But I did mention this guy, the Aboriginal professor, Alex Brown. He's had lengthy experience in doing quantitative studies, and he's in close contact with the other chief investigator, who's Gilad Zuckerman, on the linguistic side. In fact, it's so hard, it was almost inconceivable, I guess, to people in the health professions that the National Health and Medical Research Council would grant a 5-year, over $1 million, to a study that had to do with Aboriginal languages. I mean, even some of Alex's colleagues were saying, what's the matter with you guys? I mean, that should have come to us to do cancer research or something like that, you know, real health studies, rather than this other stuff. So the fact that the NH and MRC coughed up the grant is an indication that they've got confidence, and he has a good track record with them in the past, and he's done other quantitative studies. So he and the other members of the health professionals team give me confidence, but you're pointing out a potential danger which could happen. But I agree wholeheartedly with your suggestion that governments like quantitative studies. I mean, we can dish up plenty of qualitative stuff, that's easy, but the quantitative stuff really makes a difference. And as I said to people, linguistics is cheap. It's indigenous health support that's really expensive. You can get heaps of linguists for practically no money, although I wouldn't be putting that as part of the mission. Whereas very experienced health professionals are going to require a lot of servicing, so to speak.
More questions?
She is, yeah.
Yeah. And she has a very good track record in Aboriginal health.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. I sort of mentioned her in passing, but there are an enormous number of Aboriginal psychologists with PhDs in Australia, and Pat Dudgeon is one of them, and Graham G is another. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about people who are highly qualified, and I think that's partly why we got the grant. Yeah.
I have a very multidisciplinary approach to multi research.
Indeed.
And qualitative research is
quantitative and qualitative research very much part of the work. Yeah. And some of you will be familiar with the work of Michael Chandler from University of British Columbia, who's done, who's a psychologist and has worked with First Nations groups in British Columbia and demonstrated quantitatively that there are positive effects, particularly in connection with Indigenous youth suicide. Michael Chandler, when he comes to Australia, pretty well goes directly to the University of Western Australia to catch up with his mate, Pat Dodgson. So they're in close contact and form a mutual admiration society, I gather.
Others?
John.
Looks like possibly it's more of an observation than a question. Michael, do you think it's probably true to say that this research and the desire to get more quantification, I say literacy enhancement, or, you know, it's in part a reaction to kind of the Australian government
demanding, like not being satisfied with anecdotal evidence,
sure.
And now, you know, just kind of flatly demanding that we want numbers before we put money into this, things in language. It's nice to say that it's good for the Indigenous community, but can you produce any figures?
Sure. Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just a lot of academic interest, I guess, is what I'm
saying. Sure. But hopefully what we're suggesting is that if what we demonstrate for the bungalow works, then all you lot can do the same thing with whichever particular group you're working with, adopting appropriate cultural protocols that are relevant to the community you're in, but it should be transferable.
I'll just cite you in this letter, Matt.
Right. Yes, Marianne.
You know, in some way, I mean, the qualitative and quantitative studies and what do we do with them. What I've been thinking about a lot is what is the real purpose for human language, right? And if what we're doing now is digging down into what languages mean to people and what they do for people, we could see how language is part of the human psyche, and wellness is part of the human. It's all part of our ability to live in the ecological zones that we've gotten used to living in and interacting with one another. Because I think language is primarily a social thing and not
sure.
primarily information sharing. I know that's wild.
Yep.
But I believe that that's true, and that all makes sense with the kinds of studies we're looking at. And you're right, even in the United States, quantitative studies get money, and qualitative studies get pats on the head, right? So I think we need to keep down this path. This looks like a wonderful study.
Thanks very much. I might say this is a bit orthogonal to this talk, but in the state of New South Wales, I'm involved in some consultancies to do with language revival. So one of the biggest groups, or probably the biggest group in New South Wales, is the Wiradjuri, that covers a large territory of central New South Wales. Again, if I went to Ethnologue, I'd probably find there are 120 or 150 partial speakers or something like that. Because I've been delving into it, I can now say, as of late 2018, that conservatively there are at least 5,000 people learning Wiradjuri in the state of New South Wales. Australia has a possibly well-deserved appellation as a monoglot community, but a lot of those 5,000 people learning Wiradjuri are non-Indigenous, and it's claimed to some extent that the fact that there are so many non-Indigenous people learning an Aboriginal language in redneck towns has reduced the level of racism. It is possible to quantify racism in terms of money, and apparently racism is extremely expensive. So again, if you can take some cheap linguistics and put it into a community, or language learning at least, then it has substantial benefits. 20 years ago, when I first started getting into language revival, if you'd said there'd be 500 people learning Wiradjuri in New South Wales, I would have said, no way, forget it. 50 would be good, but 5,000. Australia's a fairly small place, but anyway, 5,000's a lot.
Okay, I think we're out of time for questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you.